Now it is time for the second part of my interview with pioneer Mexican-American Chicano educator, Dr. Jose Leyva. Be sure to check out part one of this interview, which was published last Monday on April 18th.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
With a career spanning over 45 years in K-12 and higher education, Dr. Leyva has instituted change within various educational environments to advance the success of all children. By sharing his professional experiences, Dr. Leyva provides us with a wealth of knowledge and a roadmap on how to empower African-American and Latino students and impact the educational system.
After leaving Maricopa, I retired and served time as an interim president in California. I had a Hispanic serving institution, Mission College, and I loved being there. I was not quite there a year. And then for family reasons, you know, a lot of times we have to make decisions for family reasons. I could have stayed in Los Angeles and could have one day, I think, lobbied for the chancellor position there. But I think my family was more important, came back to Arizona and served as a provost and interim vice president of instruction at the Pima Community College in Tucson. And then always knew that I wanted to help others. And so retired and became a search consultant and retreat consultant for the Association of Community College Trustees, and have been involved with two programs that I'm very proud of. One is the National Council on Black American Affairs has an institute for mid-level African Americans to help them become college presidents. And I was one of the two Latinos, I believe, that presented in that program. It was 4 or 5 years and mentored individuals in that program. And so I have to thank my colleague, Dr. Kevin Christian from ACCT, for involving me in that. And one of my just close colleagues, Dr. Joe Seabrooks, the president in Dallas, who we became presenters together, and it was like brothers, okay, brothers from another mother. Okay? We just hit it off, and our conversations to these leaders was keeping it real. It's all about being real, you know, but also motivating them to move to the next level. And something that struck me is that because, you know, I use my Spanish, I'm proud of it, you know, and no matter where I'm at, and I will definitely translate into English so that the English speakers don't feel left out. But I did say a few things in Spanish, and afterwards it was really interesting that the Afro-Latinos in that group, there were about 4 or 5 came up afterwards, and we had a conversation about the challenges of being Afro-Latinos. And so I really I always knew that because, you know, growing up in San Diego, we had, Afro-Latino Cubanos that came to our hood in that day. And we're going, man, what are these brothers doing on our side of the hood, man? Okay, it's time. Let's go see what's happening here. And then all of a sudden, these Cubanos say, hey, coño. I didn't know Black people spoke Spanish. You know? So I'm 16 years old. What do I know, right? Living in Nevada, you know? So, coño, qué pasa? So they, you know, they became part of our family. And then so when we were kids and we were kind of on standoffs with the local African-American homies, you know, and there was back and forth between our African-American homies and our Cubano Afro-Latino homies, you know, it was just an interesting dialogue. And I would just thought it was so fascinating, our cultures, how they're intertwined, yet yes, we still clash. And that has always troubled me, you know, and that's why I tell the story about Mervyn Lackey and Wylene Bridgman, graduates of HBCUs. And so one of the things I'm most proud of is that because of my contacts with NAFIO I think it was Dr. Roscoe, who was the director about 15 years ago, I was able to present at the HBCU President's Seminar a couple of times in a row, and just you know, when I said, yeah, you're probably going to laugh at me or throw me out of here, but I am an honorary graduate of an HBCU. And so all the presidents are, come on, Leyva, come on, stop, you know, BSing with this. I said, no, give me an amen. I am. Okay. And I told him the story. And so through stories, we connected. And I got to meet the president of Langston College, Dr. Holloway, who had been like 27 years. I think I'm retired. But for me, it was just, it was like it came full circle, you know, that here these people had mentored me. Excuse me, I get a little emotional, okay?
Yeah.
And here I am with the president of Langston College, and it's like we had known each other the whole time, okay? And we had a great conversation and dinner, and I came back and told Mr. Lackey, you know, I had lunch with him, and said, I met the president of Langston College. And so we gave each other a big hug. And so I'm really strong on cross-cultural mentoring, mm-hmm. and the fact that we have to support people of color. We have to support each other because we're always fighting for the same thing. And you see that now in the funding to HBCUs versus the funding to HSIs. But it comes one-on-one. I mean, yes. You know, right now is, as I mentioned, I retired to conduct executive searches, and getting back to the programs I'm so proud of, like I said, being a faculty, distinguished faculty member, I always loved how Dr. Christian and Dr. Williams would call me, you know, distinguished faculty. I love that. Then also the other program I'm very proud of is the National Community College Hispanic Council, which was started by the very few Latino community college presidents and university presidents, started also Haku at the same time. And I'm fortunate to have been mentored by some of those individuals. The National Community College Hispanic Council has had a presidential training program, and the director has been Dr. Ted Martinez, former community college president, and the first Latino college president that I think was at Daly College, if I'm not mistaken. And so he has been the director of the program, basically designed to prepare the next generation of Latinx community college presidents and chancellors. And so I've been fortunate to be a faculty member and also a mentor. Every year I mentor a vice president or a dean. And I'm just very proud that and I'm going to give a shout out to Dr. Mosby. I was an informal mentor, he's now president in Washington. And he was a graduate of the National Council of Black American Affairs program. And then Dr. Martha Cronin, the first Latina president at Columbia Gorge Community College, another one of my mentees. And again, she's an outstanding community college Latina. And so those are the things that have driven me and continue to drive me. So I'm still involved with the NCCHC, presenting and mentoring a VP every year. But now have transitioned a little bit more from doing actual searches at community colleges and focusing a little bit more on K-12. So about 5 years ago, I joined a search firm run by Mr. James Guerra out of Austin, Texas, the only Latino K-12 search firm in the country. And so we started with just four or five consultants, and now we're becoming one of the premier K-12 search firms for superintendents.
Wow.
Simultaneous and prior to that, I had been the program director for the ALAS, Association of Latino Administrators and Superintendents. It's a national K-12 organization with about 20 affiliates nationwide. And like the community college programs, which are affiliates of AACC, the National Council of Black American Affairs and National Community College Hispanic Council, the ALAS organization has a superintendent's leadership academy for preparing the next generation of Latinx superintendents. Howard University has one to prepare the next generation of African-American superintendents. And there's a lot of connectivity between those two programs. But I was proud to be the director for 4 years. And I had taught as a faculty member in that program for almost 9 years of its 11 years of existence. And this is the first year I have not taught. But I still serve as a mentor to up-and-coming Latinx superintendents. And I'm very proud that many of our graduates have gone on to lead large urban districts. The former chancellor of New York City, Mr. Richard Carranza, was in cohort number one actually the largest UNL public school system in the country. I wouldn't wish that job on anyone, there are those brave folks, and I wish Dr. Banks all the success as the current chancellor right now. I know he's going to take some of those initiatives that were begun and move them forward. But through storytelling, we have to motivate others. And when Mr. Carranza, I will give him some credit, started in New York City, people may not have known that he's also a professional mariachi.
Oh, wow.
And so there was a really cool article written about him that it's Chancellor by day, Mariachi by night. And so he takes his culture with him. And I love this book by a poet and Chicano activist whose wife was a professor at Stanford, and Jose Antonio Burciaga, and it's called Drink Cultura. And I often see that successful leaders of color, women and men, you know, those of us that drink our culture, literally, I mean, you know, we don't put the culture to the side. It still becomes part of us as we lead. We do a training for community college students. And I think you were at that session where we talk about, my colleagues, Ms. Brown and Dr. Rivas, we talk about the challenge for people of color who administrate, and women also, is to be able to operate entre dos mundos, mm-hmm. be able to live mm-hmm. in both worlds.
Yep. Yep.
So we grew up in this culture that doesn't always espouse the values of the education administration culture, which my colleague, Dr. Ken Magdaleno, has called it is androcentric, i.e. based on white male values. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, many people of color believe that they have to espouse and live those values in order to be successful. And successful people of color that I have known as presidents and superintendents and chancellors, you know, they drink their culture. They're able to operate in both worlds. And think about Afro-Latinos operating in three worlds.
Yes.
Okay. And I think we have to tell those stories so that others understand why we lead the way that we do. I had the opportunity over the past 4 years to interview over 20 successful Latinx superintendents, college presidents, and chancellors. And one of the things that came through so much in every one of them is they drink their culture, they live it, they know how to operate in two worlds. Okay. There is a concept called servingness, Dr. Garcia, University of Pittsburgh, and these individuals believe in serving their communities, are empathetic for their communities. The other thing I found is that these individuals, except for one, all 20 plus men and women leaders said they had felt marginalized by the education system mm-hmm. since birth or since preschool or kindergarten. Yep. And because of that marginalization, that was why they were so passionate about changing the educational system, because they did not want others' kids mm-hmm. to face that marginalization. And so it's really critical. I was interviewing one community college president who spoke of growing up in fear as an undocumented child. He said, we just grew up in fear. We're always afraid that in Spanish, we call it la migra, that immigration was going to pick up my dad, and then we wouldn't know. And as a principal my first principalship was in a migrant town west of Phoenix, which is now all houses now. But I remember there was a raid, immigration raided the fields next to the school. And all of a sudden, all the parents, you know, they started running, and the kids all knew they were scared. So we locked down the school, and kids were scared to go home, and they would go home and there would be nobody there. They'd come mm-hmm. back to the school. And so what we have to understand is that if we're going to work in the inner city schools and schools like this, we have to embrace that challenge. One of my colleagues, Dr. Kino Florida, is a retired superintendent, was principal of a high school here, and the immigration was chasing the student, and the student ran in his office. And so the immigration officers, you know, they came on, Border Patrol came onto the campus, and he refused to let them take the student.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of leaders that we need. In those
exactly. Schools. Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Those are the kinds of leaders that I try to build and help them build that repertoire of skills and realize that as people of color, we have so many skills. One of my mentee presidents, she became president of a college that had not been HSI. And during my tenure, I had done some work there with an English department of about 50 faculty members. And one of the faculty members told me this college will never become a Hispanic and Hispanic serving institution over my dead body. So when this new president came and she spoke of proudly being the president of a Hispanic serving institution with 3,700 Latino students, I believe, I'm not quite 37%, excuse me. I'm going, yes, yes, yes. And tears at the same time, because it took close to 20 years for that to happen. And so I tell my colleagues, teachers and faculty that are not of color, you know, embrace it. You know, we need you. As you all know, in our K-12 systems, I think something like 80% of the teachers teaching our children of color are white middle-class women. Mm-hmm. And we have an obligation to help those individuals because they do come in with the right idea and wanting to make a difference. But we don't give them the training, the support, and the love to deal with the issues that many of our kids come to school with. And so we have a real obligation, I think, as leaders of color to really help this generation of teachers. And then we have another obligation. You know, our kids don't want to become teachers, you know.
Yep.
Talk to any professional. They want to run their own company. They want to have their own internet company. They want to be president of so-and-so. And of our four children, now, by the way, my wife is a former superintendent also. And so we're both educators. Just our oldest son is a teacher and we're so very proud of him. And so I keep telling my youngest son who works for GoDaddy, and only has his AA, you know, you'd be a great teacher and a soccer coach. You know, Mijo, you should go back, get your degree. He says, Dad, my brother's been teaching, what, 20 years? I said, yeah, I make more money than he does. Okay. And I've been here 10 years. Mm-hmm. I can't afford to do that. And so we need to do collectively reward teachers and appropriately. And unfortunately, we seem to be going backwards. In terms of teachers. And there's a teacher shortage right now, and it's not going to go away. Our universities, our education, colleges of education are shrinking. And so where does the university cut? They cut those positions. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they will not be able to ramp up anytime soon. And again, for people of color, students of color, I mean, it's clear, Excelencia in Education, all the data that they have on Latino students and is that they can't afford to go to universities. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many community college students, you know, are living day to day. Former chancellor of the San Francisco City Colleges, we had a colleague of mine. In fact, I had hired him as a vice president and then recommended him to move into the presidency and then move to the chancellorship. Refused to evict the homeless students from the green area where they had there because they had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. Because of housing in the Bay Area, as you well know. So we
it's
have
so
many
challenges. Yeah, yeah.
We have so many challenges. And sometimes even our own leaders don't recognize that. I was, when I was at Maricopa, one of the last position I had before I retired, I was vice president of corporate development for the Maricopa Community College Foundation, mainly raising scholarships. And I get a call from a faculty member who had a single mom who needed one class to graduate, but she had taken it and dropped out twice. Well, she dropped out twice because she had four children. Her car broke down. She's taking the bus. You know, she had to buy food to the kids. You know, but she was riding a bus to go to school. And so when I got the call, I called the vice president. I won't name the name. And I kind of just, you know, I gave him the labor-ism. So okay. I drank a little bit of culture. So I'm going to give you a little bit of culture right here, sucker. Okay. I said, if you don't find the money in your budget, which I know you have, to pay for this student's class, I will personally write her a check right now, and then I'll get the foundation to figure it out. This is ridiculous that we are going to deny this woman of color, single mom, And so it worked out. Okay. They got her her class. She was able to graduate. And there's nothing like seeing four kids look up their mom. And I thought to myself, that's my mom leading by example.
Exactly.
And I can guarantee you that one of those kids is going to get a degree, if not more, but they will all be successful as a result of their mom modeling that behavior and making the sacrifices. And so I think that's what I try to impart with leaders, that you can make a difference, and it's not going to be easy. Okay. I've had some of my college president's friends I've worked with that when faculty committees send them three candidates for a position and they're not a diverse pool, they have the strength and the courage to do the right thing and send it back to the faculty or to HR to recruit a diverse pool and to bring forth a diverse pool of candidates that a college president can select in order to diversify their faculty. So there's many strategies that K-12 leaders and community college leaders can utilize to make it happen. And I think that's what I try to impart in the leadership programs that I am working with.
You have an incredible career as an educator. And I'm really curious, when you started off your story, you talked about how you weren't a very good student, but yet you became an educator. How do you translate that experience to students to inspire them to excel in school?
Well, I often, when I speak to students, I'm straight up with them. I mean, you know, I said, you know what, how many of you like school? And they're all raising their hand, they don't like it. I said, well, you know, there's a lot of things you're not going to like in life. Okay. But unless you put your mind to it, you work hard, you develop relationships with your faculty, your teachers, you put in the time and effort. I said, you always have two angels on your shoulder. Okay. You have on one angel, you have the si se puede angel. And you know, the other angel, you have the no se puede angel. Okay. And you got to listen to this si se puede angel. Okay. I listened to the no se puede many, many times. And so that's why I was not a good student. I was not confident. But I can tell you that those X's that were given to me early in my education, I think, is the reason I didn't have that self-confidence. No one empowered me. No one gave me the voice.
Yep. Yep.
Now, I did have a second grade teacher when we went to school here here in West Phoenix in Litchfield, growing up in the migrant camp, even though we weren't migrants. And my parents didn't usually go to parent-teacher conferences, but I remember going to parent-teacher conference. And of course, they were telling, you know, giving glowing reports of my two sisters and my brother. I mean, you know, but when it came to me, it was not a glowing report, okay? Because she would ask me, what's your favorite part of school? Recess, after school, before school. And, but I heard her tell my parents, your kids are college material. And I kind of believed it. I said, okay, I know she's talking about my two sisters and my brother. I know she ain't talking about me, but you know what? I'm going to believe it, think that she's talking about me. So I want to thank Mrs. Sweeney for saying that statement. I want to thank my high school counselor for telling me, you know, don't go to college because you're from Bottom Shelf, you're from the South Side, man, and you don't have the grades. So, you know, go to Tijuana Technological Institute or some other system like that, you know, and because too many of our kids don't have the confidence nor the support from a caring adult. And persistent studies tell us that the support of one caring adult in the education system can make all the difference in the world to their success.
Yes.
And so I often speak to students and say, who cares about you? And they'll tell me, well, my mom, my cousin, my uncle. I said, okay, then, you know, you have somebody that cares about you. You know, I care about you. You know, society needs you. You know, you have to take that challenge. We did my colleagues and I did a faculty workshop at Community College in Illinois, and we all tell our stories, okay? Tom Brown is Afro-Latino, Dr. Rivas is from Costa Rica, and tall, angled-looking, fair-skinned Latino, and of course, you know, I'm Mexican-American, Chicano, and so one of my story was I asked the faculty, and I often ask this to educators, what is your SAT score? You know, what was your SAT score? And so, you know, and now it's changed. Obviously, I believe that it's all changed. I hope we're going to do away with that stupid thing, excuse my language. But from 100 to 1500, you know, where are your scores? Well, my kids were, you know, 1200 and above. Okay. My wife is probably 1500 and above. I don't know. And so, so I asked them, you know, and they'll start saying, well, it was 1200, 1300, you know, 1100. I said, nope, keep going down, 900 and further, 800, further, 500. And you can see the minds of these educators going, okay, wait a minute. The system says you're not college material, but here you are with your doctorate presenting, and you've been a superintendent, you've been a college president, you've been a vice chancellor. And so I said, further, 500. Oh, honey, you got a ways to go there, girl. Okay, keep going further. And finally, you know, to get to my SAT score is 350. And so I do a little bit different version for students. Okay, and I tell them, you're smarter than I am. You know, you have more potential than I do, but it's up to you. You have that power. And it's really about empowering students with that voice and caring about them to let them know they have that power to do what I did. And so, you know, you'll get kids. I did a talk in for students in Holland, Michigan, for Holland Public School, and they brought about 600 largely Latino students, African-American students, teachers, and principals. And before that, I had done a male empowerment group individual sessions. And so there were a couple of, they were obviously gangbanger kids or homies or wannabes, kind of just giving me the look like, hey, man, who's this dude, you know? Who's this homie? Orale, what's going on, man? You know, and so I kept, okay, what are these kids mad dogging me, man? Something's up, you know? And so I just kind of, you know, didn't have time to talk to them after that session. We went to the large session and I had my speech and had lunch right before then. And I'm sitting with some students eating because, you know, you got to know who your clients are,
yep,
who your
exactly.
audience is. And if you do this great speech you prepare, but you don't know who your audience is, it's just, there's no connection. I see that all the time in diversity workshops, okay, and speakers. They don't speak to their audience. They speak to what they think their audience is. So I sat with these young ladies, and you could have thought they were neuroscientists, okay, or professors or something. So we're sitting laughing. We're talking about culture. And I don't know how the subject of in our culture is La Llorona came up. And Bloody Mary was my African-American kids used to love the story about Bloody Mary and La Llorona. And so we started laughing and then I asked, how many know the term Si Se Puede? And so they all said, yeah, we know what Si Se Puede is. So I tore up my speech, and I'm like 10 minutes later, I'm in the speech of 600 students, you know, at an all white Christian college, Hope College there in Holland, Michigan. And so I asked the students, you know, how many of you know what Si Se Puede is? Okay. And then I said, tell your colleagues who don't speak English and your teachers who don't speak English what Si Se Puede means. Well, yes, we can. You know, President Obama called Paul Chavez from the Cesar Chavez Foundation and Cesar's son who runs it and said, hey, is it okay if we use your Si Se Puede? Yes, we can. And so next thing I say, I asked half the group, you know, I want you to chant Si Se Puede, and I had the rest of the group, okay, now let's see who wins. And so we got, you know, 600 kids or teachers or faculty on Si Se Puede. And then you see all these white Christian kids looking in the gymnasium go, man, what's going on here? Is there a riot? Is there a revolution? I said, yes, it's an education revolution, man. Let's do it. Come on, join. Come on in, you know. And so it was one of the most empowering talks that, but again, you have to speak to the needs of your kids. You have to understand your kids. You have to care about your kids. As Angela Valenzuela says, you've got to connect with them at those, that basic storytelling level. And so I try to impart that information to community college leaders and K-12 superintendents. Connect with your communities. Give them voice. And so that's really what I love doing right now. I'm a part of still continuing to do K-12 searches and have joined Thunderbird Leadership Inc. And we are doing leadership training for community college leaders. They mainly have done healthcare, but we're now branching into education. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Well, Dr. Leyva, your love for young people, your love for students, your love for education shines brightly, right? And we really, really here at the Empowerment Zone appreciate you for sharing your story, because it has not always been easy to be an educator of color, and particularly a man of color, a Chicano, a Mexican American, to be in education, but then to see your impact on students, and to see also that relationship that you have with the African-American community, particularly historically Black colleges and universities, and being an honorary graduate of Lincoln University of Oklahoma. It really shows you how impactful HBCUs have been across the board, not just to African-Americans, but others, because as I always stated, education is one of those professions in the African-American community where we are really, really the experts in. I mean, that was one profession that we always have pursued in the community. And so it's great to see that African-American educators also influenced your professional and educational development. But thank you so much for taking time out to be on the Empowerment Zone. It took a while, but I am so happy that you accepted the invitation, because educational empowerment is key to the empowerment of the African American and Latino communities.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Muchas gracias. Y si se puede.
Gracias.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Angali, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.